My name's Mira Gunawansa, and I'm currently a PhD candidate at the University of Melbourne within sociology. I look at the intersection of gender, migration, and race, as you were so to call it. And I'm currently writing a thesis that seeks to understand the mental load of migrant mothers, specifically through the lens of South Asian migrant mothers, because I'm South Asian myself, so that felt like it would be most fitting.
What do you mean when you use that term, mental load?
So the mental load is a fairly new concept, particularly in academia. It essentially refers to the cognitive, domestic, and emotion work that's done to keep life running smoothly. However, when we think about who performs that kind of work or who takes on the burdens or expectations around that work, it's typically done by women, meaning that it's a very gendered form of labor. And it's considered to be quite invisible because it's done in domains such as the home or in relationship maintenance and building, etc., or in caregiving. So we see a lot of women take on extra effort and expectations around performing this, in particular, emotion work, domestic work, or caregiving work. It's considered to be very invisible because it's performed in domains such as the home or in relationship building and maintenance and in caregiving. So we often see women take on this work more because the associated expectations of who will look after someone else or who will keep things tidy and keep things orderly, it all usually falls to women or who people who present as having feminine features or inclinations. And this is terribly unfair. So while this concept is relatively new as the mental load in academic literature, there are actually sects of the literature that speaks about this emotion work or domestic work that date back to the 60s. And this is all great information that highlights how the mental load has presented itself in a very gendered way. However, a lot of this research that date back from the 60s and even to this present day really centers around experiences of upper middle class white women in the US and in Europe. And that's sort of where I hope my research comes in and kind of intervenes and breaks that cycle, because there's so much mental load or the labor surrounding that that's performed by women of color or racialized women and migrant women and women who are othered in so many other intersectional ways that have not been captured in this experience and in these definitions. And you're seeing pop culture today where people talk about the mental load, strings and bits and pieces of these discussions coming to light, but nothing's really been empirically founded or confirmed in any way. So that's where we need to, I guess, push forward in discussions on the mental load.
So previously, you've talked about how migrant women often have unique factors shaping their experience of the mental load. Can you talk a little bit more about what you mean when you talk about racialized people and also how race and people's status as migrants can shape their experience of the mental load?
So people who are racialized and who hold migrant status or any form of othered status move through the world very differently because they have to perform and engage with so much more work to fit in or meet the supposed standard that's been set in the society that we live in. And if we look at this in the lens of the mental load, we can see, for example, in regards to, let's say, safety, is carried so much more heavily by racialized individuals because of the violence that's associated with being of a racialized identity, because of racism and institutional violence and physical violence, etc. So a racialized individual would move through the world differently and would perform so much more cognitive labor, for example, in, okay, how should I dress when I walk down the street so that I'm not associated with being a part of a gang or being a dangerous individual? And how should I talk to the customer service representative when I'm making a complaint or trying to investigate an issue so that they don't think that I'm being aggressive? How do I teach my kids that they have to be extra careful when they walk around certain neighborhoods that are known for profiling people who look like us? So there's so much extra work that goes into the mental load of caregiving, of safety, and cultural code switching, for example, that needs to be recognized. And this is further amplified if you're a racialized migrant, because not only do you have to perform all of this work to enter a country, but also to stay within it. We're talking about all of the effort and labor that's required to do English tests, visa checks, health appointments, you know, ensuring that your dependents fit in their schools and, you know, in their community centers, and how can we engage and start over again? But when you're a racialized migrant, that base level of extra mental load work that you take on as a racialized migrant becomes amplified because there's a whole level of security and discrimination and marginalization that you have to factor in to remaining safe and keeping those around you safe as well. And I think that's, so you're kind of looking at this in an intersectional way where you're looking at all aspects of your identity and how they kind of compound on top of each other or feed into further either disparity or complexity. There's so much pressure put on individuals to keep producing and performing and to get results. While that's like a base level expectation that we've all followed as being part of this larger capitalistic structure. Again, I keep talking about this extra effort and this extra work or this more complex web of work that racialized, you know, migrant women have to operate within. Angela Davis spoke about this in one of her earlier books, Women, Race, and Class, I believe. She spoke about the exhaustion and the effort made by Black women who had to work, you know, far before white women had to work, and who had to engage with, like, these capitalistic structures from a very early point in history and in their lives. But yet, at the same time, in addition to working a full-time job, or, well, beyond full-time hours, let's be real, having to then come home and look after their kids and, yeah, exactly, doing that double shift, not getting recognized for it, not getting any benefits from work, not getting any support from work, still having to put on a brave face in the morning and doing it all over again, just to witness and experience so much violence out in the world, both physical and institutional, like, it's exhausting. And I think that that reality very much still exists today, and we see it presented in cases of women who are BIPOC and who are migrants who do have to do all of this extra work. Honestly, sometimes it feels like a triple or a quadruple shift because you just never switch off. And this is in such contrast to your typical white guy who gets to clock off 9 to 5. You know what I mean?
And also the implication that it's kind of natural for women to develop these skills instead of there being a shared expectation that adults should be emotionally competent.
Absolutely. It's not, as Glenn says, it's biology and that it's nature. There are a few studies that have been done that show increased levels of emotional intelligence and intuition amongst little boys having been taught that caregiving importance from a young age. I think that the unfortunate reality for a lot of women is that if they are able to pacify everyone else, then the entire event that they have been instructed to carry out will go smoothly, and then they'll get a pat on the back and everyone will be happy. And the sad reality of this structure is that women's feelings aren't accounted for at all. Like, how do women feel at the end of the day? Why are women's feelings always tied to their dependents and those around them? Honestly, I don't have the answer to why we can't focus on that more. I think it's only through collective effort of recognizing that these larger events in life and in society aren't just about results, and they aren't just about making others happy and keeping the peace. And instead, we should celebrate all of the work that goes into them and the people behind that work. And we've carved out time to do that work. So all of this invisible mental labor, once that is recognized by society, then we can start having conversations around celebrating women and the work that they do. Because we have to first acknowledge that there's a lot of invisible work and structures that constrain us from recognizing that in the first place.
I think another consequence of this as well is that I think a lot of women, and I assume it would be even more pronounced for migrant women, I think internalize this idea that their suffering is just a necessary part of life. And I think that isn't something that all people are taking for granted, that their lives are going to be difficult and unpleasant a lot of the time. And I wonder how much of an impact that has on women, and especially migrant women and racialized women, feeling entitled to actually enjoying their lives.
Absolutely. There's some really interesting literature coming from, I can't remember her name, but I'll send it to you to include in the radio edit, from a South American academic who speaks about this concept or investigates this concept of self-care amongst migrant women.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just not a thing. Like almost every single woman she spoke to said that's an inherently like selfish thing to focus on when there's so much other work that needs to get done.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really sad reality. But at the same time, I think we have to accept that we have constructed this world where safety and security comes first, and that is always going to be the goal of migrant women.
Mm-hmm.
And because that has been practiced for so long, it's become part of the norm, as you mentioned earlier. And that is a really sad reality. But what we can do moving forward as women of a younger generation who are participating in these migratory movements and in welcoming migrants into our societies is saying, hey, no, let's make a space for you to think about yourself and your emotions. And let's have this dedicated time and energy going towards asking migrant women, how do you feel? And are you okay? And not stopping at like a one-size-fits-all, one-stop solution of asking this one time. Like, this has to be dedicated effort over many, many circumstances where you then create a consistent safe space to say, hey, this space has been dedicated for you to discuss your feelings and your emotions. And it's okay to have those discussions. But I think these supports need to be built out through co-design with other migrant women and with other migrant mothers of a variety of different backgrounds so that we can make sure that it's not just sustainable, but it's also accessible to all, and mm-hmm. it's also appropriate. Because I think that speaking as someone who might be of a different generation to another migrant woman, or, you know, who's not a mother to someone who's a mother, there's a lot of room for misunderstanding and assumption